G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. And what dangerous ideas I've been peddling over the past week in conversation with Douglas Murray. It's so fascinating doing 7 live shows in 5 cities, almost all of them sold out, and wrestling and rumbling in different ways with different controversial subjects with a man who I disagree with a lot and agree with a lot as well. All of the shows were a bit different. Obviously, you do sort of the greatest hits, and I sort of ask him, you know, if it's Douglas Murray, then we have to talk about Israel and Gaza, and we have to talk about the culture wars and social justice activism. But there's quite a lot else that is innovative and original and that changed, and the audience has changed, and we sort of navigated. It was just beautiful to tap dance with a mind that is that astute, regardless of what you think of his viewpoints. So today we bring you the first taste, which is 2 Q&A sessions. We did about 50 minutes to an hour in conversation, and then we did a good 30 to 40 minutes of audience questions. The questions were submitted via an online website called Slido, where audience members can actually uprank and downvote questions, so you get a good sense of what the temperament of and interests of the audience actually are, and you don't have to put up with listening to people bang on for 7 minutes about themselves at a microphone. And next week we'll bring you one of the episodes in full, and a couple of weeks later we'll bring you another episode in full. There are also 2 videos of 2 of the events which are going to go up on YouTube. Make sure that you're subscribed to the YouTube channel. If you subscribe, then you'll get notified when all of those goodies drop. And it's also just a way of helping us. If you watch the ads on YouTube, then that's a way of feeling like you're contributing to the expansion of this project and to the expansion of sane conversation without necessarily subscribing, if you can't afford to subscribe to the premium Substack. If you are a premium subscriber, you'll get more than an hour here, because this is two Q&As. This is Adelaide and Brisbane back to back. When Adelaide fades out, don't stop the podcast, because you've got a whole other batch. If you're a free subscriber, you'll get a taste of a portion of the first Q&A only. And just a final note to say thank you to everyone who supported us in this venture. This was the first live tour that Uncomfortable Conversations has launched. That's going to be one major component of this enterprise, alongside the podcast, the Substack, and the YouTube. And, you know, one of the events that we will release in coming weeks was the Sydney Matinee, where there was a coordinated campaign outside by anti-Zionist protesters to create as much trouble as possible and create as much noise as possible and really create as much intimidation of people who'd chosen to come and see the show as possible. It's stunning to me that people would think that the best way to resolve big, complicated, moral, geopolitical questions is by shouting instead of by talking. So to those of you who listen to this podcast, that is evidence to me that you prefer talking to shouting. And I hope you enjoy as much as I did this little taste of me in conversation live at sold out shows with the one and only Douglas Murray. I have 1,000 other questions for you. Let's take some audience questions, because there are some excellent ones, and thanks for submitting so many.
Have we managed to use Slido?
Yeah, we managed to use it. You are actually the first audience who we've managed to use this this new app, which is great, because you get to actually vote
the
on each other's questions.
People of Perth could not understand it. They said, what French wizardry is this?
As we move east, the audience has become increasingly intelligent, you see.
Oh!
Kidding.
Oh.
I was a great fan of Christopher Hitchens, asks one audience member. What were your experiences with him? What influence did he have on your life?
No, I adored Christopher. He reviewed my first book, which came out when I was at university in 2000. And I remember very distinctly the first time I heard his name, because somebody came running over to me in the quad and said, and I sort of shrugged because I was young and foolish, and this friend grabbed me by the shoulders and said, "No, you don't understand, Douglas. Christopher Hitchens has been nice about you. He's never nice about anybody." And I thought, well, I'll look into this. And then we became friends. He was marvelous. I mean, I learned not to have lunch with him. That was a very important that was a very important lesson, because I was always told there were two rules of drinking. One was never drink alone, and the other was never drink before six. And I've managed to hold to the second. But Christopher didn't hold to either rule. And lunch was a long and boozy affair involving much scotch beforehand, during and after. And I would be wiped out. And I remember once turning on the television in the evening, waking up from slumber on the sofa, and there was bloody Christopher on Newsnight on the BBC, being just as eloquent as he'd been at lunch. And and he'd written an article in the meantime as well, which I read the next day. So he certainly taught me that I shouldn't try to keep up with that. He was very good at something which I really admire, and I always did admire, and he had in spades, which was his view that, you know, my own view is enough for me. You know, I don't care if I'm the only person with it. When people say things like, you know, well, you're in a minority on this one. Yeah. So what's your argument? He had a fearlessness and a bravery which was remarkable, which whenever you saw it in operation was quite something to behold. Up of sick and just plow on and often offer it to them again, you know. I adored him, miss him very much. And we only ever had one cross word, which was in about 10 years of friendship. He had, as some people know, an enormous enmity towards Dr. Kissinger. And at some point about 2004, I was seeing Christopher in the early evening and then for dinner. And I had been at a meeting with Dr. Kissinger for breakfast. And he had said something that I thought Christopher would agree with. It was to do with Iraq. And I remember thinking, I'll tell Christopher because he might find it helpful. Oh, what a mistake. I remember I started telling him this story, and it's quite often with Dr. Kissinger, because if you met him, he was a remarkable man, but he would speak like this. And so you'd lean forward and try to get it. And often you'd make a note. And you'd think at the time, God, that sounds so wise. But you look at your notes afterwards and it'd be things like, we live in a very complex world. It's not so good when it's not spoken in a kind of guttural German whisper. Anyhow, whatever it was he'd said that morning became less and less impressive as I was telling it to Christopher. And Christopher was going redder and redder, and I could see the steam starting to emerge. And he spat out, we didn't need Dr. Kissinger to tell us that. And I was like, it was like being whipped, but now I adored him.
How can Europe, asks another audience member, how can Europe handle incompatible migrants with the Turkish, for example?
Well, I read a book about this, but the long and the short of it is just so filled with problems because, I mean, think of it like this. The Germans didn't expect the migrants to stay. And that's not my view. That's the view of Angela Merkel, who said this 13 years ago when she gave a speech saying multiculturalism had failed. And she said, you know, the Gastarbeiters, they were called the guest workers in Germany who were brought in after the war in the 50s, principally from Turkey, they didn't expect them to stay. It's extraordinary in hindsight. I mean, you would have thought, again, unless you knew politicians, you would have thought that people would have worked out that if you bring in millions of young men, they might want to meet young women. And then if young men meet young women, they might start a family. And then they might want to stay where they are. And if the living conditions are much better in the place that they are, then they might not go back to the place they came from where the living conditions aren't so good. And if they can send back part of their salary to their mothers and others back home to make their living conditions better, then why would they go back to Turkey? I mean, it was the most...
Why is it incompatible, getting to that question? And I mean, you copped flack for The Strange Death of Europe for...
flack, but then everyone agreed I was right 5 years later.
I mean, you know, the criticism was that it's a sort of ethnocentric, xenophobic view to assume that migrant communities aren't going to be able to assimilate and incorporate themselves.
I don't assume that at all.
Western.
I don't assume that at all. I just think that it's people are foolish when they think that immigration doesn't have consequences. All immigration has consequences. If Australia would be very different today. If Australia had mainly been settled by Russians, it would be different. It's just the case that in some indeterminate way that is not a science, we don't know how long it takes or whether it's possible to integrate people when they come at a great speed in great numbers. And we know that as well because, I mean, in many countries in the West, people will still talk about where they're from. I think people do here in Australia. You know, people say, well, where are you from? Well, on that side, I'm Irish, and on that side, I'm Scottish, if you're lucky. We all know the question, who are you? Where do you come from? And a lot of the ethics of this country, like other countries, are formed by just simply by the people who are in it, the people who made the journey and built the country. And that's perfectly normal. I don't understand why we recognize that in the rearview mirror, but don't recognize it in the front. It's a mystery to me. I mean, it seems perfectly obvious that you know, I would say there are three things in immigration that matter: numbers, speed, and identity. And that's it. And nobody knows what the formula is because it's not a science. We don't know what numbers a country can take per head of population before it becomes something else. We don't know what speed is able to be absorbed, and we don't know what identity or identities are better than others. I think the third we have a bit of a better idea of by now.
Right, but the third is the one that we're not allowed to touch. I mean, you can adjust.
Well, I've jumped all over it. I mean,
from a policy level, you can adjust the numbers, you can adjust the speed, but it's not considered appropriate at the moment to adjust, you know, what particular.
If you come, you have to adhere to our values. And if you don't, go elsewhere. I think that's I don't see why among politicians they find it so hard just to say that. You know, if you're an Iranian who believes in our values and wants to leave the mullahs behind, come. If you're an Iranian who doesn't like us very much and you love the mullahs, really hot for them, can't get enough, would like more, mullahs the better, then maybe this isn't the place for you. Maybe Iran is the place that you'd be happier. And I think it's the same, you know, I mean, if a very large number of people from England suddenly went to Bangladesh, let's say millions of English people went to Bangladesh, and even at the height of empire, it was nothing like that. But, and they were expecting to come home, you know, but if millions of Englishmen or Welshmen went to Bangladesh, it would have an effect on the culture. Now, would it be a good effect or a bad effect? It would depend. Would it be the case that they would immediately become Bangladeshis? No. I mean, one of the things that stuns me, it goes back to the thing of gratitude and the West, is that all the countries that are currently being defamed as being most racist are all of the countries that are least racist. Like, it's all the countries where we actually mind about that. You know, when the Australian public are called racist or attacked by a politician for racism, they only try this because they know that it would wound you. It's the same with the British. We're very decent people. Among the least politician in China, and I accuse the Chinese public of racism, they wouldn't bother. Okay, so I'm racist. You know, would be the result. They don't care. It's just not a thing. So the countries which are least racist get portrayed as most racist. We get defamed horribly all the time. And the reason I say this is to build to this point, that the oddity of it is, it's in our countries that people actually do, maybe you could say not enough, but they do rise up, whatever their background. Our politics are more diverse than most countries. If my father had moved to India, say, I would not be a player in Indian politics. In fact, I couldn't be. Rishi Sunak's father moved to the UK and he's prime minister. And I'm rather proud of that. I'm rather proud of the fact that we have systems where talent can out. But you can only recognize the virtue of that if, among other things, you recognize that is not the norm. In China, nobody who is not Chinese will rise up the Politburo. Of course not. Of course not. Mm. So why do we keep just getting beaten up and being made to feel bad about ourselves for something we're actually doing pretty well?
Mm. A question about the referendum. What would you have voted for in the recent referendum? asks one audience member.
I wrote a piece in The Australian ahead of the referendum saying which way I would have voted. I think actually it's like rather pertinent to the previous point. I mean, the politicians selling the referendum were saying that treaties weren't involved when they were. And I thought that was dishonest. Much the same way as we were lied to by a lot of politicians in the UK about Brexit. I know what it's like when they try to cover it over and get around the uncomfortable facts. But yes, I mean, I was glad that the public voted the way they did. And partly, as I said earlier, because I'm always pleased when the public are given a right to vote and kick the political class in the ghoulies. But also because it would have caused untold problems, in my view, for years to come. Because once the treaties issue is opened and once the whole land issue is reopened, you fall apart, in my view. I think you fall apart. I think once everything is up for grabs like that, you're in real trouble. I hear this all the time, again, in America and Canada, which have the same sort of argument going on. And you want to say, you cannot treat the majority of the public as interlopers. It's quite wrong. Nobody alive did anything wrong. Nobody. So why be treated like you did? And by the way, the English didn't do anything wrong either. I mean, you know, as my late friend Clive James used to say, we're here because history happened. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, you can sort of litigate it endlessly and say it would have been better if the Koreans had landed in Australia or that Australia hadn't been discovered by anyone outside of Australia. You get this in America. There's this weird movement that seems to believe the best said, I haven't found anything. There's nothing out there. It's, I mean, there's a bit of land, but it doesn't have any promise at all. And I'm glad that Columbus found the Americas. I'm glad that people found here. I'm bemused by this interpretation of history that now exists that believes that, although it's something that has been around for 300 years, at least since the 18th century in France, this idea that everything that, I said earlier, everything is ours is bad, everything anyone else's is good. I'm bemused by this rewriting of history in particular, which is that the history of the West is this history of violence and conquer, and that everyone else lived in Eden. And I think most people in modern Australia would be horrified to live in the situation that Aboriginal Australians did in the past. And I'm pretty convinced that most Canadians wouldn't want to live as first peoples there either.
But we don't, because we're not. Like, we're not living there. I mean, of course, we're going to be parochial towards our own way of life.
And they will be to theirs, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But by the way,
I mean, that doesn't mean that there weren't wrongs done, surely. I mean, you don't need to go so far as to say that.
Again, though, I come back to the point of I mean, which wrongs and who? I mean, For my last book, I wrote this. I wrote one section about this delicious thing that happened with some French sailors and the Maoris. To give you the short story of it, Rousseau, who's a philosopher who's responsible for a lot of what passes for thought these days, famously used to venerate all native peoples outside of beauty. The fact he'd never been further than Switzerland was only a bolster to his theory, of course. But there's an expedition, a French expedition that lands in New Zealand in the late 1700s, and they discover some Maoris, and they've all read their Rousseau, the French, not the Maoris, and they've all read their Rousseau, or at least imbibed their Rousseau, and they go ashore and think they're all going to be, you know, Adam and Eve, and the Maoris chop them all up and eat them and things, and the Frenchmen that did survive went back to Paris with a pretty low view of Rousseau, I have to say. But you know, I mean, in the 1800s, the Maoris were in the casket wars, for instance. I know this is next door to you, but in the musket wars, they were trading heads for muskets, and sometimes they just kill somebody and give the head as a thing. Now, I don't know. Does anyone want any compensation for that? A million Europeans were stolen by the North African Barbary pirates only 200 years ago and sold into slavery. And if I wanted, I could start a movement. I could start a movement, justice for the Europeans stolen. I could do, if I wanted to destroy my society and to make people feel terrible. But I don't. I'd like to move forward. But as I said, you know, again, I return to the one of the points that Nietzsche made. He makes this astonishing point in the same work where he says that thing about justice and revenge. He describes a type of person who he says lying about their hurt. I think those people are everywhere.
Mm.
And you should have the right to at least call them out and say, you didn't suffer any hurt.
Next question is about, these are shifting around. Do you have any concerns for a second Trump presidency?
Well, my genuine fear is since the opinion polls, I mean, it's very alarming to people outside America who haven't followed this too closely. But yeah, I mean, amazingly enough, it is going to be Trump-Biden again, which I'm not sure I have the stamina for myself, but I'm not sure if they do, but if the polls show that if it is head-to-head with them currently, Donald Trump wins. I'll tell you what, I have two principal fears about him returning to office. He did some good things in office, but there's no avoiding his character flaws. And the character flaws include wild images.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen, and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations on Substack.